ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Tang stan apatata Krishna. Tang stan apatata Krishna. Ramaschan ripalilaya. Ramaschan ripalilaya. Grihita paschat charanam. Grihita paschach charanam. Prahinot china rajasu. Prahinot china rajasu.
Translation. Do I read it through first? You. Okay. All right. Translation. O King, as the demons attacked, Krishna and Balaram easily seized them, one after another, by their hind legs and threw them all into the tops of the palm trees. O King, as the demons attacked, Krishna and Balaram easily seized them, one after another, by their hind legs and threw them all into the tops of the palm trees. There's no purport, so we're going to read the next verse as well. I'll just chant the Sanskrit and read the translation. Pala prakara sakirnang daitya deher gatasubihi raraja bhusa talagrer ghaner eva nabhastalam. The earth then appeared beautifully covered with heaps of fruits and with the dead bodies of the demons, which were entangled in the broken tops of the palm trees. Indeed, the earth shone like the sky decorated with clouds. Translation again. The earth then appeared beautifully covered with heaps of fruits and with the dead bodies of the demons, which were entangled in the broken tops of the palm trees. Indeed, the earth shone like the sky decorated with clouds. Purport. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the bodies of the demons were dark, like dark blue clouds, and the large quantity of blood that had flowed from their bodies appeared like bright red clouds. Thus, the whole scene was very beautiful. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, in his various forms, such as Ram and Krishna, is always transcendental. And when he enacts his transcendental pastimes, the result is always beautiful and transcendental. Even when the Lord performs violent acts like killing the stubborn ass demons. So it's, O King, as the demons attacked. So King is Nripa, and the demons attacking is Tan Tan, all of them. Apatatata Krishna, they all fell upon Krishna. Apatatata comes from pat. It means to fall. And in English, we also sometimes say when people are attacking you that they fell upon their enemies. So the same type of language is used. So these demons, they fell upon Krishna, all of them. And Ramascha, and also Balaram. And then Krishna and Balaram, Lilaya, Grihita, Paschat, Charanam. Krishna and Balaram, they seized Grihita Paschat Charanam. And then from Sandhi it becomes Paschat Charanam, so it's easier to pronounce. And so they Lilaya, they very easily, with great ease, they grabbed their Paschat Charana, their lower legs, their hind legs. Paschat also means Western, like we say Paschatya Deshatarine, but it also means lower, second. So here it means he grabbed their hind legs. And then prahinot, they threw them. And where did they throw them? They threw them into Trinaraj. Trinarajasu means into Trinaraj. Trina means grass. are straw. And so Trinaraj is the king of grass, the palm tree, which is like, you know, sometimes bamboo also, because it's so big. So then they threw them up into the palm trees. And an obvious purport to this, you know, it's described that Dhenuka was like a grasshopper flying in or jumping into a fire when he went after Krishna and Balaram. And so all these demons, it's kind of almost reminiscent of Narasimha. And when all of Hiranyakashipu's chelas and chamchas, they all ran after him. But if he just killed Hiranyakashipu, there's just absolutely no chance. There's no chance. Hiranyakashipu was blinded. He disappeared like a moth into the fire. It would have been quite obvious at that point that the ship was sinking and they should abandon the ship, but they still chased after Narasimha and they were all slaughtered. So similarly, we see here, it seems to be a tendency amongst asuras that they don't get it. They get good instruction and it's not able to sit in their heart. And they continue to make bad decisions one after another. And of course, an obvious conclusion from that is that we should learn our lessons in life, lest we also be like them. And we should try to learn from our mistakes and improve and understand what Krishna is trying to teach us through the course of our life. I think that's a pretty safe purport to that verse. Now on to the verse that has a purport attached. The earth then appeared beautifully covered with heaps of fruits and with the dead bodies of the demons. So pala prakara. So there were like a whole bunch of pala. There were a whole bunch of fruits, like an assembly of fruits. Like we say chintamani prakara sadmasukalpavriksha. It's the same word prakara is there. It's like a whole, like an assembly, a group of pala, fruits. Sankirnan. And they mixed. They mixed together. They kind of merged together with daitya deha. Daitya dehai, with the bodies of the daityas. And those bodies were gata ashubhi. Those bodies were gata ashu. Their life was gone. Their ashu, their life, was gata. It was gone. So they were dead bodies. Just in case that wasn't clear from the bodies of the demons, it's been repeated again. And I think there's a reason for that. And so the earth then appeared beautifully covered with heaps of fruits, that's the pala prakara, and with the dead bodies of the demons, the daitya deha, which were entangled in the broken tops of the palm trees. So then rarajabhu, the earth was shining, sa tal agrer, with the tips of the tall trees. So the agra, the tips of the tall trees, they broke off, and they mixed with the fruits and the dead bodies of the demons that had their life taken from them. And it was Eva, it was just like Nabastalam, just like the surface of the sky, Ganai, decorated with clouds. You see the sky, and the sky has a bunch of clouds in it, and it looks very pretty. And so in a similar way, this looked very pretty. So the obvious question mark is that it seems quite macabre, it seems quite gory, that a scene would be described as beautiful with a bunch of demons' dead bodies, right? That would require some kind of an explanation. So generally, we saw dead bodies. Like even the boys, the cowherd boys and Krishna, they didn't eat any of the fruits. Why didn't they eat the fruits? Yeah, they knew the rules of Shaucham, because they're all Pakka Hindus in Braj. And so they know not to take things which are contaminated by blood. And so they saw that there was some blood from the demons, and therefore they didn't eat the fruits. It's described that just the scent of the fruits was enough to fully satisfy them, but they would not take them. Some of the Pulindas afterwards, some of the aboriginals from Braj, they ate the fruits because they're not so discerning. They're not so Aryan, and so they ate the fruits. the Adibasis from Braj, they ate the fruits. But Krishna Balaram, the cowherd boys, they would not take. So if they're not going to touch the fruits because they were contaminated by the blood demons, then why would we see this scene as being very, very beautiful? Right? That's it. It would be a natural question. And we see here, I'll just make one quick note. I've never lectured on one of the books translated and commentated on by His Holiness Sri Dayananda Maharaj and His Grace Gopi Puranadhan Prabhu. So when I've given Bhagavatam, I've given my share of Bhagavatam classes in my lifetime, but I've never had the occasion to read and speak from. Of course, I've read the 10th, 11th, and 12th cantos that they did. I've even taught portions of them as part of seminars or in training devotees, but I've never done a Bhagavatam class verse by verse, purport by purport. And so because I did that, it sort of forced me to think about how I feel about their purports as compared to His Divine Graces. And of course, Sri Dayananda Maharaj is the first sannyasi I ever met. I met him for the first time in 1988. He's the first sannyasi I ever offered my obeisances to, and even to this day, he is a shiksha guru and a friend philosopher and guide and a source of light to me. But all that said, and of course, Gopi Puranadhan, I just can't even begin to speak about how much respect and admiration I have for him, how much nourishment I've received from reading his Brihad Bhagavatamrita, from hearing from him. I've asked him questions when he was on the planet, and he gave me answers, and I felt that Krishna was speaking to me. But even making that disclaimer, I feel a little bit differently about their purports than I do about Srila Prabhupada's. How about you, Govinda Prabhu? Same? Yeah? Also? Yeah. So I'll say something about that, if that's okay. I'll just take a minute, I'll say something about that, because I think it's relevant, and there's so many BT, VT people here, I think it might be useful for them also. I think it's also useful for everybody. I think there's three different ways that people give class. There's three ways that Vaishnavas in ISKCON give class, at least according to my own experience. And I'll give my little system, and then if it makes sense, then you guys can accept it as truth. If it doesn't make sense, then it's just my arbitrary opinion. But we'll see if I have some insight into this. I've heard a few classes in my time, and I have an opinion about classes. Class type A is somebody reads the verse and purport, and then they talk about whatever they want to talk about. Judging by your laughter, I'm assuming that you've all been in such classes as well, and you may even have given such classes in your time. You may even have done that yourself. I would consider that, that's a wonderful thing. Anything from the Bhagavatam is sweet, it's good. But I think it's important to recognize something. Nobody does verse-by-verse translation and commentary. All of the modern neo-Hindu gurus in the world, they write novels, they might tell some leelas. Nobody does the laborious verse-by-verse commentary. It's archaic. It's sort of Victorian. It's a little, in many ways you could say, outdated. It's not the way people assimilate knowledge now. You got to do like a 5-minute YouTube video now, or a little tweet. You can't even do a whole blog. You have to do a little tweet, a few letters. People's attention span is so short. And it's therefore very significant that Srila Prabhupada chose to do verse-by-verse translation of his books. And even he would do sometimes a synopsis. He would synopsize something like Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, Krishna book. But then he would go back and he would do the Chaitanya Charitamrita and the Srimad Bhagavatam. He did not Gita Bhushan, but the Gita Gan in Bengali, but then he also did a full translation of the Bhagavad Gita. He did an abridged version with Macmillan to get it out there, then he finally printed the full unabridged version as soon as he could. And this is the way that our acharyas, our tikkakars, for millennia have chosen to comment on Shastra. they go through verse by verse. Now, when I first started reading Srila Prabhupada's books, it was almost like a grab bag of good spiritual instructions. I would read a verse, I'd read a purport, but I might as well have read this purport. I might as well have read that purport, or this one over here. I didn't connect the verse and the purport. I read the verse, because that's what you're supposed to do, then I read the purport, and I tried to learn something from the purport. But it didn't dawn on me until I read Burijan Prabhu's... What's his book called? Surrender Unto Me. It didn't dawn on me until I read Burijan Prabhu's Surrender Unto Me in 1993, or I think it was the year he put it out, that the verses and the purports were actually made to go together. And each purport was made to go with the verse. These purports represent Prabhupada's inspiration as a result of reading the verse. He, of course, also pulled from the comments of so many Tikkakars going back 1,000 years in our lineage and put them together and added his own realizations. But they represent what Prabhupada saw when he looked at the verse. As such, our primary duty, the first thing we should do when we give class in this format, is we should connect the purport and the verse. We should look at the verse, we should look at the purport, and we should figure out why did Prabhupada get inspired from reading this verse, and why did he think these thoughts in the purport? We can notice that he also saw things from Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and where he differed, maybe at his own points, where he offered an alternative point of view, where he modernized something and brought it into a contemporary discussion. But the main purpose is we look at the verse, we look at the purport, and we connect the dots. And sometimes Prabhupada's purport is in his translation. Sometimes he puts his purport in his translation. To be a verse this big, and his translation will be this big. It's because he's put his purport in, he thought it was so important, he put it in there. Sometimes he'll miss something in the translation, and you'll find it in the purport. Maybe he thought it was so important he didn't want to deal with it simply in the translation. He saved it so he could dedicate several sentences to it and really unpack it. Sometimes he offers one translation in the verse and another translation in the purport of the same idea. Sometimes the word by word, when he was doing it himself, is one way, the translation is another way, and the purport is a third way. And our job when we read Shastra, and especially when we teach Shastra, the first thing we should do is we should figure out what Prabhupada was saying, why he was saying it, to the best of our ability. And we should explain that and connect the dots for the audience. And then we can add some little kind of spice, a little bit of masala on the top if we want to, of our own thoughts on the verse or something else we read that might be interesting. So that first way of giving class where you simply read the verse and purport, and then speak whatever you want, not ideal. The more spiritually advanced you are, the more you're going to end up hitting a bullseye anyway, because everything you think of is spiritual. But in some ways, it does away with the necessity of having the Bhagavatam in this format and having a Bhagavatam class. Way number two is you read the verse in purport, you find some sentence in the purport that you like, and you use as a springboard to then talk about whatever you want. So it's not completely free. The other one's like jumping out of an airplane, just free, sailing through the air. This one is a springboard. You jump on the verse, you find one thing you like, and then you kind of run as far as you can. And because we are Vedantins, this is really easy to do. And if you guys will indulge me for a minute, we're going to get back on track in just a second. If you'll indulge me for a minute. Do me a favor, just somebody in the audience, you can raise your hand, I'll call on you. Think of something that has absolutely nothing to do with what this class is about. Perhaps something which is as opposite as humanly possible. And that was, I'm not being rhetorical, I actually want somebody to raise their hand and come up with something. Like the gum on the bottom of your shoe, or you know, like anything you want to. A pair of horn-rimmed glasses, like whatever, like anything on the planet other than this. That's what you had for breakfast, right? South Indian Day today. Yeah. You're one of the takers that set from 7:15 to 7:45, right? Yeah, okay. Okay, great. You know, sometimes you eat prasad. Like today, we had medu vada. It's not my favorite. I don't like South Indian prasad. I don't know what it is. For some reason, it's not my favorite. And so for me, it's very macabre. I don't like it at all. It's exactly the opposite of what I want. But in the same way that prasad is offered to Krishna, the same way Krishna and Balaram, when they killed the demons and the demons became very beautiful, in the same way this prasad, which is not according to my liking, it is still beautiful because it was offered to Krishna. And when you honor prasad, you should not think about how it tastes. You should think that it's offered to Krishna, and then it becomes all auspicious. Hare Krishna! It's easy. Think of something else. Somebody give me something else. Anybody else? An expensive car, right? You want an expensive car. That's what you want, but maybe you can't afford one. Life offers us so many reversals. We have our desires, but then we have Krishna's plan, right? And we have to learn to come in consonance with Krishna's plan. Just like these demons, they didn't get it. So you have to learn not to be so attached to your fancy brahmachari car or your pen or whatever it is you're attached to, your sika nicely formed, whatever it might be. Just like Ramanujacharya and his disciples, they became attached to their kopin. And another disciple was unattached even though he was a great... And you can just go on and on like this. We can connect any dot we want to. Because we're Vedantins, which means everything comes from Brahman. And so it's not too difficult to pull it back to there and then jump off to wherever else you want to go. That's the reason. So that's type 2 class. Type 3 class is you figure out what Srila Prabhupada was saying, why he said it, and you speak from that. So I don't feel exactly the same necessity when I'm reading Hridayananda Maharaj and Gopi Pranadana Prabhu's purport. When I read Prabhupada's purport, it's like Shastra for me. And I say like Shastra because sometimes Prabhupada intended to speak something in a joking way. Sometimes he intended to make a simple point here, but he makes a much more elaborate point some other place. You have to learn to flow with Prabhupada, to go with the flow of what he's saying. But in general, when I read Prabhupada's words, I think that's what Krishna wants me to hear. That's what Krishna wants me to think of. I need to train my mind to think of the same things that Prabhupada does when I read the verse. And so the more connections I can develop between the verse and the purport, the more I come in consonance with Prabhupada's way of looking at the world, and the more I cultivate the attitude and the behavior and the mentality of a pure devotee, which is why I'm doing sadhana. I feel like that towards these other great Vaishnavas in our lineage, but not with the same degree of intensity that I feel towards Srila Prabhupada. Does that make sense? Okay, so with that as my disclaimer for what I'm going to speak next, that was actually related to what I wanted to talk about. We hear here that the bodies of the demons were dark like dark blue clouds, and a large quantity of blood that had flowed from their bodies appeared like bright red clouds. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, whose disappearance day is today, his comments are just a little different than what Hridayananda Maharaj said here. They're not antagonistic towards or completely separate from, but they're just a little different. He makes the point that this sankirna, this mixing, the dark bodies of the demons and their red blood, they mixed together, and it looked like clouds at sunset. You follow? So the red clouds and blue clouds, that's true. But you could almost say what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur was saying exactly was that you had these dark clouds like the clouds at night when they start to become dark, but then the sun's still shining through them, and there's that little bit of red on those clouds, and it's mixed, the dark and the red, and it's very beautiful. And in Prabhupada's words, because we have the Krishna book, which is especially useful when you're looking at these verses, because in the Krishna book, mm-hmm. Well, maybe we don't have the Krishna book. I'm not seeing it here. Prabhupada says that there were many different colored clouds and they looked very panoramic. And so Prabhupada was touching on the same thing when he was reading the Krishna book, when he was writing the Krishna book. And then he also touched on this verse when he said that bodies of the demons looked like many different colored clouds and they looked very panoramic. There's no doubt that when Prabhupada said that in the Krishna book, this was the verse he was reading. He may have also been reading the commentaries, but there's just too much in common. So we have even Prabhupada's own translation of this verse. Anyway, I thought that was relevant to read. And I think that this Gata Ashu, that the life had left their bodies, because there's nothing in the verse that says there was blood flowing from their bodies which mixed and made it look like these clouds at sunset. It's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura's own contribution. It's his own realization. And so, but I see, I'm looking, where did he get that from? Where did it come from? And I see Gata Ashu. Their life had gone. So how does your life go from your body? Huh? Your life leaves your body, right? Sure, you say your life is gone, sure. But if somebody cuts you with a sword, you follow? And you're bleeding profusely, it's almost like your life leaves along with your blood. And so there may be some subtle indication that he's seeing here, that the life leaving their bodies, because you could have said daitya deha, the bodies of the daityas, and it already said they were killed. It would have been implied that they were dead bodies, but it says this life had gone from them, and it makes you think that the blood had flowed and they died. And that's maybe where he was sensing that the blood was indicated, and he was extrapolating from that. And this brings us to another point, which I think is worth considering thinking about. You remember class yesterday? Well, I'll say this first. I think a simple explanation is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur saw Krishna's pastimes. Sometimes there might be something which is not mentioned in the Bhagavatam, or very, very slightly mentioned, and by his spiritual insight, he's able to actually have a sakshat darshan. You follow? Because he's a swarup siddha. And therefore his writings are the writings of someone who's gone to that side, stepped into that world, and can come back and report what they're seeing. And Prabhupada says, in the second canto, he says that the pastimes of Krishna are factually televised on the heart of a devotee when he closes his eyes. Beautiful, right? Beautiful, isn't it? So I think that's a simple, straightforward explanation. But I want to problematize that a little bit. I want to complicate that a little bit. Because I don't think that explanation by itself is sufficient. It's nice when you first start studying something, everything is very simple, it's black and white, there's one answer to every question, and you're very peaceful. It's like a Kanishta Bhagavat. A Guru, Krishna, bus. I can't think too much about different classes of people and being merciful to one and avoiding another and making friendship. That's too many things for me to think of. We say, kith, keep it simple, stupid. And so for a child, you just can't tell them so much. So when we're spiritually like children and we have komala shraddha, we have soft faith, things need to be made very simple. And in that neophyte stage, devotees are a little fanatic, a little judgmental. They don't have the full broadness of vision, and it's healthy. That's how they sort of keep themselves from getting influenced. And as they become more advanced, they can reach out a little bit more, and eventually they can reach out everywhere to everyone without being disturbed. In some ways, the move from Kanishta Bhagavat to Uttam Bhagavat, it's a question of how much you can see Krishna when you look around. The Kanishta sees only Krishna, only the deity, only the guru. Then the Madhyam Adhikar, the Madhyam Bhagavat is able to see kind of a broader spectrum. He's able to appreciate the Sajati, Snigda, Uttam Vaishnav, make good association. He's able to give mercy to innocent people, and he's able to avoid envious people. The Uttam Bhagavat, he looks everywhere, he sees Krishna.
It's the inclusiveness of a vision that determines how advanced somebody is. So in the beginning, it's a good thing to be a Kanishta Bhagavat, because you're some kind of Bhagavat. At least you're connected to the tree. You're going to get good association. It's beneficial. But if we look at the last verse, the verse that Jai Srila Prabhu spoke on yesterday, Sanatan Goswami offers three options. The verse says, Tata Krishna Charamam Cha Jatayo Denukasya Ye Kroshtaro Abhyavya Dravyan Sarve Samrabdha Hata Bandavaha. That the demons attacked Krishna and Balaram. But Balaram just killed Denuka, so it would make more sense to say they attacked Ram and Krishna. But it says Krishna and Ram. So he offers three options. Option A, Krishna jumped in front of his brother to get between, right? Between the demons and his brother. Number two, Balaram went over to protect Krishna, so they were sort of together, and so Krishna was mentioned first. And then finally it says here that they saw the prowess of Balaram, and they thought, ooh, he's too tough. We'll take Krishna, he looks a little smaller, a little less strong, doesn't have a plow in his hand, he's got a flute. He looks like he'll be a little easier to defeat. So he offers three options. You follow? So those three options indicate that he wasn't simply seeing the pastime and telling us what this is going on in the spiritual world. It indicates he was looking at the verse and he was working within certain parameters of interpretation. And he was offering us several different possibilities of how the verse could be legitimately interpreted within the parameters of what the verse is offering. This demonstrates that conjecture and philosophizing and intellectual speculation within certain guidelines is acceptable. It was practiced by our acharyas. Sanatan Goswami sometimes will do it with his own book. The Brihadbhagavatamrita, he wrote a commentary on the Brihadbhagavatamrita, and he writes like he's commenting on Shastra. He was the vehicle, he was the rishi through whom that Shastra came. But when he comments on it like he's commenting on the Bhagavatam. This verse, this word could mean this or could mean this, maybe it means this, maybe it means that. He saw that Leela, he wrote that Leela. He put that book together. He was the rishi who saw that Leela. But then he comments on it the way he would comment on sacred Shastra. So this demonstrates that we have both options. There's the possibility of interpreting the verse legitimately, and then there's the possibility of seeing Krishna's pastimes. And I can ask all of you, which one do you think is most important for us? Both? Huh? He said, one person said both, one devotee said both. What's most important for us? Huh? Seeing. The other one. Why is that one more important? We should learn how to interpret the verse in a legitimate way because we're not yet on the platform when we can see the pastime. Therefore, this one is accessible to us immediately. The other one, we may have to wait for a few days. I agree with you, yeah. And so I see here in this beautiful purport of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, paraphrased expertly by Hridayananda Maharaj and Gopi Pranadhan Prabhu, that there's both elements you can see. There's both things you can see. And you can see that they're looking at the verse, they're looking for some way to describe the verse in a poetic way, to give some further stuff for the meditation of a devotee. At the same time, the possibility is there that they also simply saw something amazing, something wonderful, as a result of their extreme spiritual advancement, and they left those drops of nectar for us. They're dancing, they're drinking, they're drunk on Krishna Prem, and those drops, because you can't dance and drink at the same time, so some few drops are falling out of their mouth, and if we get close enough to their feet, those drops will land on our head, and we'll get to drown in those same drops, and then we can become mad like them, and then maybe the other possibility is there as well. What time do we normally give class till? 9:15. I'm just getting warmed up, but I could end there. I can ask for questions. We can end there. Are there any questions thus far? Comments? Yes, Prabhu.
Conversation between Krishna and Arjuna.
Let me just repeat what you said because you weren't on the mic. I want everybody to hear what you said. He said, if you read the Sarartha Varshini commentary on the Gita, he really goes out on a limb and just says amazing things. He just goes for it. He's like the greatest poet ever, right?
Yeah.
Please continue.
Yeah, so I appreciate what you said about how Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he's like, has some higher realizations because of being in that realm and going into that realm and then coming back and relating it to us, because he says things that Krishna's thinking when he said that in the Gita, or Arjuna, what he's thinking, and relates those things to us so that we really get some insight into this conversation, between Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhagavad Gita.
Thank you very much for that comment. Thank you very much, Prabhu. Anything else on what we've spoken about thus far? Okay, so we'll continue. Thus, the whole scene was very beautiful. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, in His various forms, such as Rama and Krishna, is always transcendental. And when He enacts His transcendental pastimes, the result is always beautiful and transcendental, even when the Lord performs violent acts like killing the stubborn ass demons. So the next thing I want to talk about Krishna and Ram. The Ram here is, looks like it's Ram. I'm thinking he's thinking Ramachandra. I don't know. We could call Hridayananda Maharaj if he wrote this purport and ask him. But it looks like he's thinking of Ramachandra. But it could be Balaram just as easily. But one thing is that, in general, the Lord, in His various forms, everything He does is all auspicious. This is true. Because Krishna and Vishnu are one, according to Siddhanta. So whether it's Varahadeva is just as transcendental as Krishna. Krishna has a sense of humor. You got to pick something up from a dirty place, so he comes as a boar. And we learn from that Krishna is pure and transcendental in any circumstance, in whatever form he takes. It's a very important lesson. In fact, when we show people the deity of Krishna, we generally don't tell them about Krishna. We tell them about Vishnu. We show them a picture of Krishna, and we say, Parichranaya sadhunam vinashaya traduskritam. But that's not Krishna. That's Vishnu. I'm going to make this point a little bit more elaborately, but I want to sensationalize it a bit, so I'm making that strong point without having evidenced it just yet, because I want it to really sink in. When we show people and we speak from Gita that Krishna's coming to vanquish the demons, that's Vishnu. Krishna doesn't kill demons. We show people a picture of Krishna, we tell them about Vishnu. When someone becomes a Vaishnav, then we show them a picture of Krishna, we tell them about Krishna. When they become an advanced Vaishnav, we show them Krishna, we talk about Radha. And when they become really advanced, now we can speak about Chaitanya. So, according to Rupa Goswami, although Krishna and Vishnu, Narayan, are one in Siddhanta, they are not one in Rus. In Rus, they're not one. This argument was made. Venkat Bhatta argued with Mahaprabhu. He said they're one in Siddhanta. And Mahaprabhu said, yes, but they're different in Rus. And he tried to convert him to worship Radha Krishna instead of Lakshmi Narayan. You can see this in the Lord's travels through South India. It's elaborately described. Krishnadas Kaviraj says, that when Krishna kills a demon, it's not Krishna killing the demon. It's Vishnu kills the demon. Because Vishnu is automatically in Krishna, because Krishna is avatari, so all the avatars are in Krishna. Krishna doesn't kill demons. Vishnu kills the demon within Krishna. This point is made very directly by Srila Prabhupada and Krishnadas Kaviraj in Adi Lila chapter 4. Furthermore, killing demons is his anusangakaran. It's a secondary job. It's a bahirangakaran. It's an external reason why the Lord came. And so when we look at a verse like this, I think a very straightforward purport that needs to be made is whatever Krishna does is all auspicious. If some demon's being killed, if some reversal happens in life, there's some good purpose. And I think any of us can understand this and appreciate it. Every devotee I've ever met, myself 1,000 times over, something happens, I think it's terrible, I'm really upset at Krishna, how could he do this to me? I'm so devoted, I've dedicated my whole life to you, Krishna, why are you punishing me in this way? Don't you know how much bhakti I have for you? You're helping so many people, why are you abandoning me? Am I the only person who's ever felt like this? Raise your hand, have you ever felt like this? You may all be too sadhu to feel like this, but I've even gotten angry at Krishna. Sometimes in my just deep delusion, I've complained to Krishna, like, don't you know I'm your devotee? I gave my whole life to you, Krishna, don't you know? Of course, this is like so far from the truth, but somehow the elaborateness of my delusion is just, it's almost, you know, it's just astounding. But then, you know, I look back on my life a few minutes later and I'm brought to tears because I realized Krishna actually saw so much further than I did, gave me just what I needed, put me just where I needed to be. Have you all had this experience before? So that's a very easy purport, and that's the purport that these two great Vaishnavas are making here. Prabhupada didn't make that purport when he wrote the Krishna book. Vishwanath Chakravarti didn't make that purport. It's a contribution of Hridayananda Maharshi, but it's in complete consonance with our philosophy. It's totally legitimate. It's a very, very beautiful point. Very nice. But we see, you know, so he's killing demons, but they're blessed. That's not something about Krishna. Hatari muktir dayaka. That he gives liberation to the demons he kills. That's what Narayan does. Krishna's separate from Narayan. And so we can appreciate what they've done, but then we can also add something. And this is why I made the point that I feel a little more comfortable jumping in and adding some extra details. I might be a little more reserved about even thinking like this, but because it's purports of, they're my Guru Varga, but I feel a little more comfortable making this point. So I think what they said is a very nice principle, but I want to add something to that. And the point I wanted to add was that what I'm going to say now is so kind of heavy that I want to read it because I don't want you guys to say, what did you speculate? How could you say such a thing? Anyway, the killing of the demons is anusanga karma, secondary work. I shall now speak of the main reason for the Lord's incarnation. The Lord's desire to appear was born from two reasons. He wanted to taste the sweet essence of the mellows of love of God, prem ras niryas. And he wanted to propagate devotional service to the world on the platform of spontaneous attraction, rag marg prachar. He wanted to preach rag marg, and he wanted to taste prem ras. And thus he is known as supremely jubilant and the most merciful of all. He's known as Rasik Shekhar, the chief of the Rasiks, and he's known as Paramakaruna, the most merciful. Who's being spoken of here? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, right? Wrong. This is a verse about Krishna. This is Krishna. Of course, now, if this is Krishna, what's the immediate question we have? This is Krishna. It's directly stated in the verse and in the purport. And from the context, it's very clear. If this verse is about Krishna, What's the immediate question we have? Huh? What's left for Chaitanya, right? If this is Krishna, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is a next step, you follow? Where else is there to go? Where else is there to go? There's not time, because I have 2 minutes to finish class. So we're not going to have a chance to get into that. But Krishna came for two reasons. Prem Ras Niryas and Rag Marg Prachar. He wanted to preach Rag Marg. Listen to this one. Aishwarya Shitila Prem Nahimor Prita. Prem cooled, made Shitila, made Shitala, made cool by Aishwarya Nahimor Prita. It's not dear to me. It's not dear to me. Here's Srila Prabhupada on this point. Sakala jagate mode kodi vidhi bhakti brajabhave paita nahi shakti. Everywhere in the world people worship me according to scriptural injunctions, vidhi bhakti. But simply by following such regular principles one cannot attain the loving sentiments of the devotees of Brajabhumi, Brajbhav. Vidhi bhakti? No Brajbhav. Knowing my opulences, the whole world looks upon me with awe and veneration. But devotion made feeble by such reverence does not attract me. And Prabhupada's purport. By following scriptural injunctions, vidhi bhakti, one may enhance his appreciation for the glories of the Lord. But there is no chance for one to enter into personal dealings with him. Giving too much attention to understanding the exalted glories of the Lord reduces the chance of one entering into personal loving affairs with the Lord. To teach the principles of such loving dealings, the Lord decided to appear as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The next chapter, the same verse is given, and it said, actually, this is why Krishna appeared. Thus leaving us, well, then why did Mahaprabhu appear? So in chapter 3, it's why Mahaprabhu appeared. In chapter 4, Krishna takes over. The same exact verse is mentioned in relation to Krishna, and it begs the question. You start to think, why did Mahaprabhu appear? And in that, when the verse is given again, a second time, in the fourth chapter, then the comment is, such apparent killing by Lord Krishna took place as a matter of course and was incidental for him. The real purpose of the Lord's appearance was to stage a dramatic performance for his transcendental pastimes of Brajabhumi, exhibiting the highest limit of transcendental mellow. These reciprocal exchanges are called Rag Bhakti. Lord Krishna wants to make known to all conditioned souls. Who are conditioned souls? Me. That's right. So Krishna wants to make it known to us. What's he want to make known to us? Here it is. That he is more attracted by Rag Bhakti than Vidhi Bhakti. There it is. He wants to bestow the privilege of Rag Bhakti. Thus he appeared on his own. So, the last point I'm going to make, I'm just still kind of warming up, but I want to respect the timing for the class. So I want to kind of try and wrap this up with a little bow tie real quick. This picture, when you first encounter God, then we have to say Samoham Sarva Bhuteshu. Krishna is equal to everybody. Suhridam Sarva Dehinam. Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam. He's the friend, well-wishing friend of all living entities. Krishna doesn't want to make you suffer, but it's yayatamam prapadyate. Whatever you do, Krishna reciprocates. If you want to love him, he also wants to love you back. He wants to love you even if you don't, but he gives you your free will. He's acknowledging that. Yata ichasi tata kuru. What you like, you can do that. He's acknowledging our free will as a factor. And so he doesn't force. And even he kills. Some blessing is also there. Who am I talking about? I'm talking about Vishnu. First entry level. Te mayi, they are in me. Nat te shu aham, I am not in them. Krishna says this in the Gita repeatedly. Everything is in me. te mai, na te shu aham. I am not in them. I'm beyond. I'm transcendental. But then Krishna says about his bhaktas. He says, te mai, they're in me. Te shu aham. I am in them. Krishna's praying vasya. He's controlled by love. Prem Vashya. He's controlled by love. He's conquered by love. The idea of God being conquered. The unborn being born. Krishna carrying his father's shoes on his head. Krishna crying. Krishna being bewildered. An ordinary person can't understand this. Once one has become purified, these same points which would bewilder a normal person, they are so sweet. And now you're talking about Krishna, the private life of God. If you want to work in that realm, the price is lobh, which is normally a bad thing. But just like here, a bad thing became a beautiful thing. The gopis' prem is called kam. It's celebrated as kam, Rupa Goswami says. And we don't want lobh. We want to get rid of lobh. It's one of the narak dvars. It's one of the doors to hell, the gates to hell. But we want lobh for Krishna. Because lobh is the fee you have to pay for rag bhakti. Rag anuga bhakti. You have to have lobh for it. You have to think, I want to embrace Krishna. I want to dance with Krishna. I want to wrestle with Krishna. I just want to be with Krishna. I know I'm not qualified. I don't care anymore. Asha Bandha. I'm bound to this hope. I love Krishna. I want to be with Krishna. My lack of qualification is less than Krishna's magnanimity. Just like Narottam sings, Patita Pavan Hetu Taba Avatar Mo Shama Patita Prabhu Na Pai Bhayar. I'm Maha Patit, but you're Patit Pavan. You're more Pavan than I am Patit. You'll save me. My lack of qualification is less of a meditation. Your mercy is more of a meditation. When you want to appreciate that, then these verses, these poetic verses, they become essential. You have to take Srimad Bhagavatam Rasam Alayam. It's an abode of Ras. It's meant for Rasik Vaishnavas. And so the Bhagavatam is filled with beautiful poetic descriptions. And in that description, you find some life, you find some encouragement, you find some food for meditation. And I'll just close with this as another example. This is about Yashoda. Dressed in yellow saffron sari, with a belt tied about her full hips, Mother Yashoda pulled the churning rope, laboring considerably, her bangles and earrings moving and vibrating, her whole body shaking. Because of her intense love for her child, her breasts were wet with milk, her face with its very beautiful eyebrows was wet with perspiration, and malati flowers were falling from her hair. This is Prabhupada's translation. Prabhupada's translation, Damodar Lila. Purport. Anyone who desires to be Krishna conscious in motherly affection should contemplate the bodily features of Mother Yashoda. Therefore, this description is provided. Advanced devotees must cherish this description, always thinking of Mother Yashoda's features, how she was dressed, how she was working and perspiring, how beautifully the flowers were arranged in her hair, and so on. I want you to take full advantage of the description provided here by thinking of Mother Yashoda in maternal affection for Krishna. So in these verses, with these beautiful comments of our acharyas, we find some poetry. Kavi Karnapur, he says that the juice fell down on the ground and the ground became muddy, and then the unripe fruits, the cowherd boys took them and they were playing with them like you would play with balls. They're like throwing them around, playing with each other. So they give us all these details and they create a picture in the Shastra, in their writings, and in that picture you can enter in. So first explanation, whatever Krishna does is a blessing. The demons he killed, they're liberated. Entry level explanation. With any incarnation, whatever they do is all auspicious. Second explanation, Krishna's sweeter. He's not killing the demons. That's Vishnu. Krishna's mugdata. He's bewildered. From mu, mugdata. And he's sarvagata. He's all-knowing simultaneously. Vishwanath Chakravarti Kaur makes this point. When Krishna's running from Yashoda, he's not pretending. He's really afraid. And we know he's really afraid because Kunti Devi was bewildered seeing it. But according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura, Kunti Devi is an Aishwarya Gyan Bhakta. She knows all of Krishna's opulences. And so if he was faking it, she would know. But she says, I'm bewildered seeing you running from your mother. That's because Krishna's actually bewildered. Because Krishna's engaged in his pastimes, but he always manifests his sarva-gyata feature, his all-knowing feature, to hear the prayers which are made by the raga-nugiya bhaktas in this material world, because Vishnu can't hear those prayers. Only Krishna can hear those lobe-laden prayers, those lolium-laden prayers, those prema-laden prayers of these devotees who will only be satisfied with Krishna and Vrindavan. In this way, I wanted to offer a couple of different angles of vision. Thank you all very much. Are there any final points, comments, corrections, questions? I went over time, but for me, this is like super quick. So please forgive me for going a little over time. I'm very grateful to be here. Thank you all very, very much. Hare Krishna. Govinda Prabhu, is there time for a question? She's asking. I'm asking you for permission. Yes? I was thinking about that also. I will say this. She was hoping I would speak something more about these great Vaishnavas. So in 30 seconds, I'll say one thing.
Actually, could you say something about Vasanta Panchami? If you could connect that dot, please.
I mean, I don't know where to begin. It's Vasanta Panchami. Krishna has his Vasanti Ras Leela and his Sharadiya Ras Leela. And so Vasanta Ras Leela is going on now. It's very, very sweet. You can speak about it forever. I noticed that it's very auspicious that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is blessing us today with his thoughts. 400 years later, his thoughts are here and we're reading them on his disappearance day. And one thing I'll say about Raghunath Das Goswami is, as our Prayojanacharya, he was extremely renounced. And as I was walking through the lack of a brahmacharya ashram yesterday, I walked through and I saw bathrooms and hallways and I saw a library, but I didn't see any brahmacharya ashram. I saw lockers, but there was no brahmacharya ashram. And then I found out that the brahmacharis here, they just sleep wherever. And I was so I'm so grateful that there's exemplary Vaishnavas living such a lifestyle. I feel like I'm in a great place of pilgrimage. And I can't help but think of Das Goswami's incredible renunciation. And I think that the devotees in Chalpati are paying a really nice homage to Das Goswami by the way they're living their lives. Please continue. Fallen grihastas like myself on the other side of the world, hear about your glories, and it inspires us in our devotional service. Okay? At least something? Thank you for making me do that. I wanted to include it, but I knew I wouldn't get to it. I didn't even get halfway through my class. Thank you for getting me to do that. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.